Well, for those of you guys who are here, it's excellent to see you. You're probably 80% women and 20% men, because the rest of our men are, of course, on this men's retreat. So I'm excited to be able to just have all of this representation of all the women in our church who can really step up to do this Sunday morning, from worship to speaking to announcements to prayer. It's so great that we can participate as a team like this. My husband already did say that he's sore, and it was from softball. So they are going to come back really, really tired. So we're in this series called Relationship for Christians, and Jeremiah introduced it a couple of weeks ago, and he sort of gave us the overall umbrella of how this series was going to go, talking about how in our faith we serve a God who is relationship. God the Father, God the Son, God the Spirit are in relationship, in a triune relationship with one another. And because we are made in their image, we are called to be in relationship with one another as well. We're also many parts of one body. And so how do these body parts work together to form the church? So he started with that. Then last week he talked about commitment and covenants and how that's just sort of the basic foundation, a bedrock really, in order to do relationships, especially as Christians, is where we can apply that commitment and that covenant. That's where we're going to see growth. So this morning what we're going to talk about are needs in relationships, how they get missed and how they get met. And this is something that is really appropriate for me to even be digging into and trying to understand, because it's something that Carl and I argue about regularly. And so, in full disclosure, this is something that for 16 years of our marriage, we have come at this in very, very different ways. And so we've had to learn how to approach the idea of how do we get our needs met and what we do when they get missed. Because I approach needs as this sort of blanket idea that if you say what you need verbally, you communicate it very clearly, then it should get met. That's the expectation, right? Yes. Sue's like, good luck with that, right? And that's what I have proposed that Carl do. However, Carl's on the other side. He fully believes that needs don't need to be said. You should be able to see what the need is and then move to action to meet it. So we often have this hurt involved where I've set a need and I expect it to get met and it doesn't get met. And he doesn't get a need met because I didn't have eyes to see that it needed to be met. And so we go about this in very, very different ways and have really had to negotiate how we do this. And so that's what I'd like to try to unpack a little bit today, is how do they get missed and how do they get met? And so with the way that I've sort of organized this material is in what I would like to call a Jesus sandwich. Okay, so we're going to start with a story, and we're going to end with a story, and there's going to be a whole lot of Jesus in the middle, all right? That's where the good stuff is. So the first story that I want to bring up is from the New York Times bestselling book called The Kite Runner. Many of you have probably read it. And this story is about a boy named Amir, who is born in Afghanistan in the 70s. He grows up there for his childhood and leaves in 1978 when the Soviet Union invades Afghanistan. He makes his way through several different countries and ultimately immigrates to the United States and lives in San Francisco. He stays there for about 25 years, and we're coming up right on the turn of the century, when he gets some disturbing news, really some secrets that came out about his family, and it's been made very clear that he needs to go back to Afghanistan, specifically for one family member. But it's been 25 years, and now the Taliban is ruling, and so just flying to Afghanistan to pick up this family member and bring them home is not an option. But he is compelled. So what he ends up doing is he ends up flying to Pakistan, and there he has to meet with someone who is able to not only just facilitate the communication and the resources of how to do this, but he has to find out how to get across the border and into Afghanistan. So he does this. He meets with someone there, and he gets coordinated or hooked up with a driver named Farid. And so Farid has this old beat-up Toyota Land Cruiser that can make it over this mountainous terrain that is treacherous right between Pakistan and Afghanistan. So they spend the entire day crossing the border, going up through these back roads, passing villages and towns. It's definitely a long and arduous journey. And they get to a home that ends up being Farid's brother's house. This is his brother Wahid and his wife Miriam. They come to his house and they are greeted with a hospitable Afghani welcome. They are offered some tea. They sit down and they discuss what the purpose is of Amir's journey and what's going on there. Miriam and her mother are in the kitchen, and they're speaking to one another, and Wahid then says, you know, it's time for dinner. Why don't you guys come sit up at the table? We'd like to feed you some vegetable shorwa or some kind of soup. And so he apologizes, and he says, I'm sorry, we don't have meat to offer you, but the Taliban are the only ones who get this meat right now, and so this is all we can do. It's a humble supper. And they said, no, thank you. Please sit down. Let's eat together. And Wahid said, no, our family, this is a late hour. We've already eaten. Please, you go ahead. So Amir is sitting there, and his and we have Wahid and Maryam, we have her mom, and we also have three boys in this picture. They're their children who are sitting over on a kind of a frayed mattress against the wall. And Amir and his driver, Fareed, are eating this soup. And so as they're eating this soup, Amir looks over, he's speaking to Wahid and Maryam, and he's eating the soup, and he glances over at the boys, and they are staring at his wristwatch. Their eyes are glued. And so he's thinking to himself, you know, I would like to offer a gift for their hospitality. And so he says, Wahid, can I please give your boys my watch? You know, it's something that I'd like to part with. And Amir remembers back to when he was 12 years old and he received a very special watch that is an integral part of the entire story when he was that old. And so he thought, I would like to gift these boys with this watch. So Wahid agrees, you know, and says, yes, yes, please, you know, go ahead, you can do that. So Amir takes off his watch, he hands it to the boys, and he shows them how to use the time, that it tells time in all the different time zones, and he hands it to them. And they begin to pass it back and forth, and he goes back to eating. Well, very shortly after they are done eating, the boys have left at this point, and he looks down, and the watch is cast onto the ground. And they're not playing with it anymore, and he's thinking, well, that's strange, that seems like an odd thing to do with a pretty nice gift. But he goes on, he gets prepared for bed, and he steps outside, and this is the first time he's been on Afghani soil for 25 years, and he's standing there, and he's looking out at the stars, remembering his childhood, and as he's leaning against the wall, he overhears Maryam and Wahid through the window as they are speaking. And Maryam is tearing up, and she says, but the boys, what about the boys? And Wahid says, I know we're poor, but we're not savages. They are our guests. They needed a meal. And she said, what will we eat? What will I feed them? And at that moment, Amir realizes they weren't watching his watch. They were watching his food. It's a tragic story, but I think the reason why this particular vignette grips me from the middle of a much larger narrative is because it's so complex in all of these different characters and what their needs are and how they get met. And we feel bad for Amir, right? Because he's trying to do something good. He's doing something that he would have liked when he was 12 years old living in Afghanistan. And yet, that is not what they needed. So think about who you resonate with in this story. You have Maryam, who is torn between the hospitality that is expected of in the Afghani culture and how she takes care of her three young boys. You have the three young boys who can't advocate for themselves to say, we want your food, not your watch. And then you have Amir, who's been gone so long, he's just disconnected and hasn't realized what the Taliban has done to the country and that it is no longer the Afghanistan that he was born into. So what do we do with this complexity? So many needs. How do they get met? How do they get missed? Well, what I want to do is at least take the angle of Amir. And I want to try to kind of unpack and see a little bit about why he might have missed these boys' needs in particular. So I've created sort of this list of just some possible reasons why needs get missed. The first one is that Amir made a lot of assumptions. He just assumed that the boys would want this watch. He assumed that Afghanistan was the same way that he had left it, even though he'd heard news reports, he hadn't experienced it for himself. He assumed that they were watching his food and not and watching his watch instead of his food. He made some general assumptions. And when we make assumptions, they're going to often be inaccurate because we haven't got any kind of confirmation. Another one that he does is a form of projection, and this is a psychological word that just means you take what you think you want and you project it onto someone else and imagine that it's what they want or what they need. And so he took his own story of what he wanted as a boy and he projected it on them without really seeing them in their particular situation. They're sitting on a frayed mattress and they're super skinny, and yet he's assuming that they would like a nice watch rather than food because he's projecting his needs on top of theirs. That's one way. He's also preoccupied. He is going over there on a mission. He's traveled for the length of this day over bumpy roads and mountainous hills. He's concerned about this family member that is in Kabul that he needs to get to. He's just not really paying that close of attention. He's also been a lot of distance between him and this society. 25 years have gone by since he's been there. A lot has changed. He's been disconnected. That's another reason why he doesn't know what their needs are. And then the cultural customs. Well, sometimes we go to meet a need and we don't recognize that the cultural customs that are in play right there will make it difficult to either understand and meet that need or to do it appropriately or in any other fashion. So there's this barrier here that he doesn't understand either or doesn't appreciate or because of the distance he doesn't remember. These are just some possible reasons why needs can get missed. But what I really want to illustrate or stress is that there's one sort of umbrella reason why needs get missed, and it's this. Needs get missed because we are human beings who sometimes miss things. We are human beings who miss things sometimes. We'd like to hold a mirror to a greater standard, but had we walked a mile in his shoes, we would have responded probably the exact same way. We are human beings, and so we sometimes miss things. And there's grace, and there's mercy, and there's forgiveness when that happens, but we don't have to stop there. We don't have to stop there with just that place of, yes, we are humans, and sometimes we just miss things, but we do have a model or an example of how we can maybe get closer to this idea of meeting needs instead of always missing them. So we're going to look at now the Jesus portion, a whole lot of Jesus right in the middle of this sandwich. And we're going to start in Matthew 26, 36 through 46, and we're going to read. This passage is just before Jesus' trial and crucifixion when he goes to the Garden of Gethsemane. And so as we read, hopefully that text looks bigger to you than it does to me back there because I can't read it from there. Okay, good. I'm signaling you can read that. Okay, so we're going to read through this, and I guess what I would ask you to do is to be thinking about needs and how they're getting addressed in this particular passage, where you find yourself, who you identify with yourself, what you would wish would happen, what you're mad that happened, those kinds of things, and find out where you identify with that. Then Jesus went with his disciples to a place called Gethsemane, and he said to them, "Sit here while I go over there and pray." He took Peter and the two sons of Zebedee along with him, and he began to be sorrowful and troubled. Then he said to them, "My soul is overwhelmed with sorrow to the point of death. Stay here and keep watch with me." Going a little farther, he fell on his face to the ground and prayed, "My Father, if it is possible, may this cup be taken from me, yet not as I will, but as you will." Then he returned to his disciples and found them sleeping. "Couldn't you men keep watch with me for just 1 hour?" he asked Peter. "Watch and pray so that you will not fall into temptation. The spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak." Jesus went away a second time and prayed, "My Father, if it is not possible for this cup to be taken unless I drink it, may your will be done." When he came back, he again found them sleeping because their eyes were heavy. So he left them and went away once more and prayed the third time, saying the same thing. Then he returned to the disciples and said to them, "Are you still sleeping and resting?" You can almost hear his disbelief. "Look, the hour has come, and the Son of Man is delivered into the hands of sinners. Rise. Let us go. Here comes my betrayer." Jesus is about to encounter the ultimate moment in his life, and he asks his closest friends to pray for him. Not once, not twice, three different times, and every time they fail him. Imagine his disappointment when he says at the end, "Are you really? This is the third time I've asked you. I'm in a crisis here. I am sorrowful, and you couldn't stay and meet this need of mine." They missed this opportunity to meet this need. But I think what is so striking to me in this passage that just sort of unravels all my normal paradigms and the way I approach things practically and rationally is Jesus's underbelly of vulnerability. He just exposes himself and he says, "I am in need. I am so much in need that I'm not going to ask you once. I'm going to ask you again when you fail me and again when you fail me without real promise that you're going to succeed, but I'm still going to ask." He takes his own needs that seriously that he asks someone else to meet them three times, even though they fail him. That's mind-blowing. That is not something you would hear from someone else. If you went to say to your friend and you said, "Hey, you know, it turns out that I really need my boss to give me a raise, and I asked last year, and then I asked again this year, and then I asked again this year, and they just didn't do it for me," that friend would not tell you, "Go ask again," or, "Oh, wow, that's really disappointing." They would say, "Quit your job and find somewhere else." That's the kind of practical advice you would get. Or better yet, what they would say if you're in a marriage and you say to your friend, "Hey, my husband, he's just not able to meet this need. I've asked him this time, I've asked him this time, I've asked him this time." Your friend would probably say, "You know what? And you probably, that need probably isn't going to get met. Maybe you should stop having it." There's a way that we dismiss our needs. And here what Jesus is doing is he's saying, "My need is valid. I am in crisis. You are my best friends. You are the ones who have followed me for 3 years. You know what I need. Please stay and pray for me." And he does it time and time and time again. And what is he left with at the end of the day? He's left with disappointment. And yet that is our model. Jesus is our model. What do we do with this? How do we make sense of this? Well, I think when we take things out and we sort of just kind of pick one passage apart, it gets difficult to wrap our heads around this. But this is what I believe is something different. And what follows is this encounter that he has with Peter. So Peter goes on to not only stay awake and pray for him, he then betrays Jesus three times. And in the next passage that we bump into where Peter and Jesus are speaking directly post-crucifixion and resurrection, this is what we get in John 21. Again, the first recorded message of Jesus and Peter speaking to one another. Jesus is standing on the shore. The men are in the boat. They're trying to catch fish. Jesus says what to do with the nets, and Peter looks out and he says, "That's Jesus." So he jumps out of the boat. He runs to the shore, and he encounters Jesus, and this is the conversation they have. When they had finished eating, Jesus said to Simon Peter, "Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these?" "Yes, Lord," he said, "you know that I love you." Now, if that were me, I would be thinking, did you love me when you didn't stay away and pray for me when I asked you to? 3 different times. Did you love me when you were betraying me? 3 different times. I would have a really hard time with his answer when he says, "You know that I love you." So Jesus, he asks again, he says, "Feed my lambs." And Jesus said again, "Simon, son of John, do you love me?" And Peter answered, "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." Jesus said, "Take care of my sheep." The third time he said, "Simon, son of John, do you love me?" And Peter was hurt. Peter was hurt because Jesus had asked him the third time, "Do you love me?" And he said, "Lord, you know all things. You know that I love you." And Jesus said, "Then feed my sheep." So there's a lot of research on this passage. What is Jesus doing? Why does he ask him 3 times? But for the sake of what we're discussing today, I'd like to suppose that this is a 3 times in a sense that he's really getting a hold of him and he's going, "Okay, I've asked you a couple of things before and you haven't delivered on them. In fact, our most recent engagement was you betraying me. I am going to give you another chance. I need to ask you 3 times. Do you love me?" There's a way he gets a hold of him. There's a way he looks him in the eye. There's the way that he speaks to his heart, all with compassion and grace and forgiveness. And he says to him, "Do you love me?" "Yes." "Okay, then here's what I need you to do. I need you to feed my sheep." And Peter then becomes the rock that the church is built on. It took lots of times, in fact, 9, really, of Jesus asking him for help before Peter delivered. And that's our model. Our model of how we get our needs met is asking not once or twice or 3 times or 6 times, but 9 times before a need gets met. What do we do with this? This is not practical. This is not rational. This is not logical. But this is Jesus. This is our model. That in relationships, we hang on. We hang on. We hang on to ourselves and our needs that need to get met. And we hang on to the other and say, "I believe you and I know you want to meet these needs. I'm going to work with you until they can sync up." And so here's just a few things I feel like I can learn from Jesus' example in a sort of list form that we can begin kind of looking at and unpacking and try to take with us. Because I think it's a huge pill just to swallow the fact that this is what Jesus is asking us to do. This is the model. We can't explain this away. We can't say, "Oh, well, he didn't mean it," or, "Oh, it's because he's divine." Yes, he is, but he is also human. So we can't explain this away, but these are some examples of how I think that Jesus eventually got his needs met. 1, he knew his needs. Isn't that funny? Like if you were just to ask, kind of like, I wonder what's one thing I'd really like my husband to start doing for me? Starbucks and chocolate. Yeah. You know? But do we know? Do we know what our needs are? I need more affection. I need some better communication. I need you to pay attention to me when I'm speaking. I need you to be home more often. I need you to be invested in what I am doing. Do we know what our needs are? Have we been able to engage the fact that something's not getting met in order to say, "This is what my need is"? Because Jesus was very, very clear. "I need you to stay awake and pray for me. I need you to stay awake and pray for me. I need you to stay awake and pray for me." Very clear he knew his needs. And he made a direct verbal request. "Peter, do you love me? Feed my sheep. Peter, do you love me? Feed my sheep. Peter, do you love me? Feed my sheep." I mean, his redundancy is so funny to me because we would never do that, right? We'd feel like we sounded like a broken record. We would feel like we were being way too vulnerable to ask more than 1 time. And yet this is exactly what Jesus is doing. He knows his needs. He's making a direct verbal request. He repeats it, in this case, at least 9 times he's asking for a request. He practices forgiveness. He sees the best in Peter. He knows that Peter loves him because actually when you go back, Peter pulled in a mirror earlier in this story, because right after the Garden of Gethsemane and he falls asleep and doesn't do what Jesus asks him to do, instead he picks up a sword and cuts off the soldier's ear and he says, "Here, there you go, how about that?" And Jesus is like, that's not what I needed. Now I have to pick up this ear and put it back on. So you practice this sense of forgiveness and then Jesus is saying, "Okay, you missed it, You missed it, you missed it. I forgive you and I'm going to try again. I forgive you and I'm going to try again. Easier said than done. That's why sometimes these like lists don't necessarily work, because much easier said than done. But nonetheless, that's what he's doing. Jesus is practicing forgiveness. He takes a risk on Peter. Man, Peter was a wild card. In fact, my son is named after this Peter. And he's a wild card too. But the hope was not that my son would be a wild card. That was not the goal. That's not what I was hoping for. I was hoping that my son would grow up to be the rock on which something else could be built as well. Jesus saw the best in Peter. And that's why he held out all 9 times. Because in the end, Peter becomes the rock on which the church is built. Man, what would have happened if Jesus just like didn't believe in him back, you know, after he was betrayed? Or worse, Peter didn't rise to the occasion to try again and did what Judas did and hang himself for his betrayal. This shows you that this relationship is Jesus asking and forgiving and asking and forgiving, and finally Peter shows up because Jesus believes in him. Do we believe in our partners? Do we believe in our families? Do we believe in our friends that they really want to meet our needs, that Amir really wanted to meet the needs of these 3 boys? Really wanted to, but yet there's so many things that get in the way. There's this like complex miscommunication in the middle. And yet Jesus is modeling how we get around that or really go right through it. And in the end, Jesus' vulnerability is so striking to me that he exposes himself as having a need, and yet he's the king. He exposes himself as doing it 3 times when anyone else would have called him a fool. He is vulnerable enough that he knows his need and asks to have it met. That's one way that I think that we can, these are just a few examples of how I think that we can get our needs met. But man, is that a hard road. That's a really hard road. So that's the Jesus in the middle. That's the whole lot of Jesus. And I want to end with just one more story. This one is about a personal story about Carl and I. So I've never been the touchy-feely type. I don't know if it was that, I don't know. I grew up in a family where we weren't super affectionate, and so that might be why. But I also am moving too fast usually to try to like be sitting too still long enough, you know? And so Carl has always been the touchy-feely type. Hugs, kisses, holding hands, snuggling on the couch, that's his jam. And so from the very beginning, it was like, you know, when people would say, I need a hug, I just didn't understand that. I'm thinking, how can you need a hug? I'd rather have Starbucks and chocolate, you know? I was like, let's make that as an exchange, you know, and so it was just something that we kind of had to contend with. And so I knew that it was something that he needed. He knew that it was something that I didn't really respond quite well to. And so we just kind of met sort of in this weird, funky middle place where when we were snuggling on the couch, I would be sitting there going, can I go yet? Is it time? I just move, you know? I just had things to do, or my mind was going or whatever, and so I'd want to get up and keep moving around, you know? And so I just kind of had my space. But this has gone on this went on really for almost 15 years of our marriage, where it was where he really needed that to feel connected. I didn't, but I tried to meet him in the middle. And yet he never got rid of that need. He never just stopped. He never just stopped trying to hold my hand or stopped trying to snuggle or stopped trying to give me a hug and a kiss. I mean, I'd be running out the door and he'd be like, wait. And I'd be like, come on, you know? And it's so funny because Lucy has the same attribute now. She's our oldest, but it's with the dogs. So I'll be, come on, girl, we got to go. The bus is about to leave. She's like, hang on. Bye, Gizmo. Bye, Pippin. I'll see you later. You know, there's just so much affection, you know, it's such a deep sort of connection that I just didn't quite understand, because time is my priority. I want to get there on time, and a hug is going to set me back. And so it was just this way that I went. But Carl never changed. He never changed. He never budged on it. He wasn't overbearing or anything, but he never lost it. Still, every single day, hugs and kisses. Every single day, snuggling and holding hands and that kind of thing. He never lost that need. He just respected that I couldn't give it to him, maybe, in the way that he would have liked, even though I would like to meet his needs. And so this went on for about 15 years. And then last year, I went to this training conference, and it was for psychotherapy, but it had to do with all the sort of chemicals in our brain and what happens in our neurobiology. And I'm hearing that physical touch causes your brain to explode with good things. Dopamine, oxytocin, endorphins, all these connective chemicals that make you feel like you're, you know, really being understood, you're being soothed, you're being calmed, you're being healed. And I'm sitting in class and I'm hearing this and I'm thinking, wow, man, I've been missing out. I mean, who doesn't want to feel that good, you know? So I'm thinking, okay, all right, well, I need to practice this. Okay, so we're going to, and of course Carl needs no practice, but I do, right? So when we get home, it's, hello, endorphins, dopamine, oxytocin, yes, yes, you know? And this is me kind of stumbling through the process of recognizing that it makes you feel good, right? Well, so I'm in this class and I'm understanding it on a very logical way, in a rational way, and so I'm understanding it. But then I get thrown into this season in my life where I was working for an organization that was really generated a lot of fear in me. There was a lot of fear of liability and litigation and not dotting your I's and crossing your T's and third-party payments, and it just was very, very stressful. And there was a lot of fear to the point where I was waking up in the middle of the night with nightmares. One Saturday morning, I got up at about 5:30 and drove all the way over to Bellevue to make sure I had followed all the protocol for how to lock up the office and those kinds of things. And it became crippling and paralyzing and so super anxiety-provoking that I didn't know what to do. And so I would be so afraid to either talk to my boss, or when I finally put in my notice, I had these 3 weeks of still having to go back, and I was so terrified for a number of different reasons, which is less important. But what was important is that Carl was right there, ready to go with what I actually needed that I didn't know I needed all along. Is that I had been sitting there in this place going, oh my gosh, I don't know what to do. I don't know if I need to go for a walk. I don't even know if I need to call someone. I don't even know if I don't know what I need to do. And I remember from this class I had just gotten out of, I was like, I think I need you to just hold me. And he was like, okay. In his mind, okay. He's like, yes, I've waited 15 years for this, you know. And so we proceeded over the course of these 3 weeks to every night, it was just like bear hugged. You know, and I was just, it was the only relief I got. We would sit there for, I don't know, 30 minutes or an hour, and it was the only time I could actually begin to fall asleep. And it was just oxytocin and dopamine and endorphins. And so I'm getting my shoulders rubbed and my back rubbed, and I'm being held, and I just felt so safe, like I was in a blanket. And I was like, oh, this is what I needed. And I had no idea. I had no idea that this was available the entire time. I just didn't know I needed it. That was a turning point. Turning point for me, turning point in our marriage, because what I realized is that, number one, I didn't know what I needed. Number two, Carl had been so patient holding on to his own need that he was ready to deliver as soon as I was. Just like Jesus had held on to believing the best in Peter, Carl was just patient. You know, he didn't know what he was doing. He was just patient, and he was accepting, and he was okay with all of that. But when it came time for me to really say what I needed, understand what I needed, he was right there to meet it. And so then what I discovered, that was the first time I recognized, this is what Jesus means. Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst, they're going to get filled. But we'd like to assume that it's easy, or we'd like to assume that we should just get our needs met without much struggle, or that we should just be able to, you know, be filled up without having to ask directly, or whatever it is. It's hard work. I hope I've shown you that this is complex. This is complex stuff. And yet when we engage our needs in relationship with someone else, and we hold on through forgiveness and grace and trying again and again and again, needs get met, lives get changed. Peter's did, mine did, and I think that yours can too. But man, this is hard work. So I'm not sure that we can all swallow this sandwich, right? Because what it involves is recognizing that we are humans and we will make mistakes. Can we extend grace and compassion and mercy to ourselves and to others who fail when we don't meet needs or when they don't meet our needs? Can we do that? Can we express vulnerability time and time and time again, believing the best in people and yet being patient until they can meet our needs? Can we do that? And then in the end, can we recognize that maybe there's something out there that can already meet a need that we didn't even know we had? I don't know what that'll look like for you, but I thank God that that's what it looked like for me. As hard as that season was, I would never go back to that season. It was so difficult for me, but I would go back if it meant that I learned what I learned, which is that Carl is available and able and capable to meet the very thing that I needed and I didn't even know. Relationships are challenging. Faux shizzle. I mean, they are hard work, right? I mean, really hard work. And yet, I think if we can look at Jesus' example, as odd as it is, and as countercultural as it is, and lead with vulnerability over and over again, after forgiveness, we pick ourselves back up and we ask again, I'd like to see what kind of surprises can happen if we follow that route. All right, let's pray. Jesus, you amaze me. I just cannot believe how what you will call us to do is so different than what we often hear. It doesn't feel rational. It doesn't feel logical. It feels like we're really stepping out in faith. We're stepping out in trust. We're stepping out to believe the best in one another. Ah, may we do that with our partners, with our family members, with our friends. May we hold out to believe the best in one another, to know what our needs are, to bring them before each other, and be patient as we slowly, slowly begin to see them getting met. I thank you for the crisis in my life that brought me to this place of understanding that when I mourn, I will be comforted. Thank you that your truths resonated with me in that way, and I've been changed ever since. I pray that you will do that in the lives of all of our members here in this body. In Jesus' name, amen.